GodBlogCon podcast. My name is Dustin Stevie. I'm the senior director of GodBlogCon. GodBlogCon is coming up in just a month now, a little bit less than a month, on September 20th and 21st. If you haven't registered, be sure to visit our website, www.godblogcon.com. Today we're doing yet another speaker interview with John Mark Reynolds. John Mark, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well.
John Mark will be speaking at GodBlogCon. His session out at the conference is on the art of online conversation. John Mark, can you just briefly tell our listeners who you are and what your topic is going to be about at the conference?
Well, I'm going to try to speak on why we should communicate well, or at least in ways that, while getting attention, don't draw bad attention to self, and ways that will help us dialogue in a lasting manner. Some people make a big splash the minute they get on the internet. They have one big post or they say nasty things, but then their nastiness catches up with them. On the other hand, there are other people who are so careful about what they say online that it's so horrific to read them. It just puts you to sleep. So how can we be ourselves, but our best selves, and so survive inside the new media? That's going to be my topic. Some of what I've learned, of course, I've learned by doing things badly. So it's not like I'm coming in as someone who always does things well. I'm learning right now as we go, learning how to wrestle with people in comment folders without, you know, being bad with people's disappointment in my writing. So that'll be the topic, and hopefully that will be something that will help people who come to GodBlogCon because they're involved in new media and want to stay involved.
And John Mark is the founder and director of the Tory Honors Institute. Tory Honors has been a sponsor and a presenter of GodBlogCon for the last 4 years. So thank you very much for that.
Well, as a leadership training program, and this is something I would say to anybody involved in either training Christian leaders or in being a Christian leader, either inside the church or parachurch ministries, pretending that the new media is even new at this point is, you hate to say this, but just silly. We're going to have to learn to communicate in different ways. Conversational styles in some ways will have changed and in some ways will not have changed. And trying to figure out what can change, what can be let go of, what, as the president of Biola put it, what is just a way of saying things like vinyl records and what is intrinsic to our message. You know, what can we not abandon? We can move our recordings from vinyl to CDs or to MP3s, but we shouldn't change the music we're making just because the medium has changed. And so what are the unchanging things versus what are the changing things? This is the kind of thing we talk about at GodBlogCon. We try to wrestle with ideas, and too often internet conferences or new media conferences become about the technology. But really, people at this point are no longer entranced with the technology. I assume I can get Green Bay Packers scores or information at any moment from my iPhone. I no longer am overwhelmed by that. So there you go.
And to talk to him about the changing and unchanging things of web media today will be Catherine Britton of Crosswalk.com, their news and culture editor, as well as Marcus Goodyear of TheHighCalling.org and Matthew Anderson of MirrorOrthodoxy.com. Catherine Britton, why don't you go ahead and lead us off with an interview of John Mark Reynolds from the Tory Honors Institute.
Hi, John Mark. Thanks for talking with us today.
Well, it's a lot of fun.
Well, thanks. My first question for you would just be about the topic that you're speaking on and the title, which I found quite interesting. And you were talking about how at the Tory Institute, a lot of what you guys are dealing with is what are the changing aspects versus the unchanging aspects of conversation. It sounds like that's coming out in your topic. And my question is, a lot of people would look at that title and say, the art of online conversation, isn't that an oxymoron? How can technology be an art? How can we have a real conversation via the internet as a medium? Can you explain that?
Well, it is a good question. If you think about letter writing, nobody would think it was odd to say that you can carry on a kind of delayed conversation through letter writing. And online conversation is faster, but because you're not incarnate, you're not there physically, it's a little bit like writing a letter, only fast. So you're presenting yourself by means of words. It's indirect. And that self is preserved. People can go back and look at it later. In that way, the new technology isn't that new. But it's immediate or very close to immediate in a comment box on a blog or in a blog for people who blog daily or on email chat sessions, which Google preserves for you forever. So learning what the new rules are and learning where the rules haven't changed. So, for example, an 18-year-old should write with their 40-year-old self in mind. Yet at the same time, those of us who are in our 40s, maybe I'm the only one here who is in their 40s, I have to remember that I can know more about people when they were 20, 21, now. And when I interview 31, 32-year-olds, they've probably been on the net for a decade. And I can actually see what they wrote when they were 24 and 25. And fortunately, you can't see what I wrote when I was 24 and 25. So we're going to have new rules all the way around about what we'll tolerate and what we'll do online.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, do you have a follow-up to that? I want to make sure I answered the question you had and not the question I thought I heard.
I answered that very well. I do find it interesting that many people still regard the Internet as very impersonal, whereas you would equate it to letter writing, which is something people would say is more tangible.
No, I think it was only impersonal back when the technology got between people and their conversation. But maybe this is because I'm an Apple user. At this point, the technology, I just never think about it. My computer simply does what I want it to do all the time. Maybe people who are struggling still with Vista don't quite have this experience yet, he says, taking shots that are cheap and unfair. But I think for most people, especially college-age people or people in their 20s, they no longer think about the Internet as impersonal. In fact, it's the most personal part of their lives, and some of that is sad.
Indeed. So you would say it is more about context at this point, though.
Yeah, it doesn't have anything to do with the technology, nor is it merely information gathering. At this point, we take for granted, I think, that I can find out any bit of information immediately. Now, some of this is pseudo-information. A lot of Wikipedia is simply false. It does best on technology questions or science questions. It does the worst in some other areas where it's most trusted. But I still believe that people think they can get information almost immediately, and they just take that for granted. That's not how they think of the Internet or new media anymore. They think of it as a way, having gotten the information they need, having received the information they need, a way of using that information, of interacting, of relating to the people that they know.
Oh, definitely makes sense. Thank you.
This is Marcus Goodyear of the HighCalling.org.
Yay, good group.
At the HighCalling.org, we say that we're helping people glorify God in their daily life and their daily work. And this is an election season, so it starts to get complicated.
Right. You don't have to tell me about that, right?
Right, right. I mean, we have interviews. On our site, we try to be specifically bipartisan, so we have interviews with people like William Gray, who was the majority whip of the Democrat Party in the House of Representatives.
Right.
And we've had interviews with people like Jonathan Aiken, who was a conservative from England, and Mark DeMoss of the DeMoss family, which is sort of known for being conservative.
Right.
My question then is, what advice do you have for bloggers who are looking to weigh in on politics with their personal opinions, but they still want to honor God and the church in the process?
Well, I've tried to do that myself. I think the first thing is, as a college professor, I have to realize that whether I like it or not, I also represent Biola. So I always try to write everything I write as if the president of Biola is going to be held accountable for what I do. And I also realize that if I take political stands, however carefully I nuance them, however carefully I say it's my point of view, people are going to be offended. It would be easier if I never wrote about politics. I would get less flack. As far as I can tell, I've received no personal benefit from writing about politics. But I think it's important for me to both show my students and the broader Christian community how I've tried to integrate my role as a citizen in this republic with the rest of my life, with my life as a philosopher, with my life as a teacher. On our blog, in fact, I end up doing a lot of the political writing because not because people disagree with me or because I'm particularly politically obsessed, but because everyone else doesn't want to do it. And so I tend to carry the ball there. And hopefully I am a good role model. We tend to be a conservative group at our university. I think one thing we have to remember, I'm not believing the church is the Republican Party at prayer. I am a principled person first. I'm a monarchist, no king but King Jesus. Fundamentally, and that always has to be true. On the other hand, when we think about bipartisanship, we have to remember that at least white evangelicals are probably about 70% going to vote for the Republican Party, And I sometimes think on the web that people attempt a false bipartisanship, a 50-50 bipartisanship, when really our community is probably, if we're talking about non-minority evangelicals, and I don't want to just talk about non-minority evangelicals, we're probably closer to 70-30. And so I would hope that it doesn't get to the point where the fact that I am a Republican and my family's been Republican since Abraham Lincoln saved the Union and freed the slaves. When Virginia seceded from the Union, my family seceded from Virginia, is the best way to describe my family history. I would hope it wouldn't get to the point where it's bad that I'm a Republican, kind of embarrassing, and everyone secretly wishes I was a Democrat for life or something. And I see a little bit of that trendiness, but then I've seen it my whole life, and new media has just exacerbated this tendency. So there's a long blurb about religion and politics. Do you have a follow-up, something I could help? Does that sound insane?
Well, I did, but you just kind of floored me with that last comment about feeling that you're called out for being a Republican.
Yeah,
I think if people on both sides always feel called out for whatever stand they take.
I think that that's probably right, but my perception is, in new media, that we always act like it makes us really sad that, I don't know, people at Focus on the Family might not like us if we were liberal Democrats, when in reality we don't, if you're this kind of person, you don't hang out with that kind of person. And that in fact, to pick a very different kind of group, a TV evangelist and a TV evangelist minion saying nasty things in your comment box actually gives you a feeling of warmth and security that you are not a right-wing fundamentalist. So I think sometimes we give ourselves courage points for offending people that we don't actually like. And I have some concern online that it will become trendy to kind of despise and loathe the actual people that are sitting in the pews, let's say our spiritual grandparents, and give ourselves courage points simultaneously for offending people that in reality we don't hang out with, we don't like the TV they like, we don't like the music they like. And so sometimes what we posture as being courage, great courage on our part, just turns out to be enormous conformity, where we're sitting on the back of some bus of people that we actually like, being the token evangelical, the token right-to-life member who's tolerated. Now, I think that happens on the Republican bus, and I think that happens on the Democrat bus, but the kind of person who writes for new media, the kind of person who's very involved in this, tends to be younger than I am, and I'm afraid they sometimes posture as if they're courageous. Oh, look, I'm offending all the people who are Republicans, when actually those aren't people they mind offending. And that's my only, it's kind of an old guy pastoral point. It would be equally damaging if, in fact, I was sucking up to those people. But as a philosopher, I doubt that I, too, just want to suck up to that kind of person. So there's a long rant about this.
Well, thanks.
Yeah.
John Mark, Matthew Anderson,
Hi, Matthew. Hi, Matthew Anderson.
Hello. I'm a little bit curious. You mentioned that most people who do this are younger than you, and I, in fact, am one of those people, as we both know, who is younger than you.
Well, I suspect everyone on this phone call is younger than I am at 45, so.
previously, my question is really about the structure of blogging and some of the assumptions behind it, and really whether or not those assumptions are inherent to it. Previously, the publishing industry had lots of walls in place to keep out bad writers, et cetera. But
right.
One of the side effects of those walls was that it really did hammer the egos of young people who wanted to publish.
Yeah, that's right. You got turned down all the time because you're not one of the established people. There are certain writers that I greatly admire and that have helped me in the course of my life, like Jim Dobson. Let's face it, if he writes a book, it's going to sell a lot more copies than if I write a book. And so traditional publishing has tended to take a few risks, but mostly go with name brands or people that they could understand.
Right. It seems like the idea that blogging circumvents that structure or what makes it interesting and what makes it go is some kind of inherent narcissism that's built into it, where young people like myself can avoid all the ego smashings that in a lot of cases are necessary for young people.
The ego smashing, though, here's what I would say to that. I think the ego smashing was an accidental good that occurred from the old system. So we could say this, an accidental good of the fact that people only had fireplaces and light in one main common room was that they were forced to do family things together in the evening. If they were going to stay up when it was dark, and in rural West Virginia you were often too tired to do that, but if you were going to stay up when it was dark, you had to be in a common room. So an accidental good of that was the family circle of the Victorian era. Now, when new technology came, light bulbs, of course the family circle was assaulted accidentally because people now could be in every different room of the house. How could we avoid that? Well, simply by not doing it. So here's what a younger writer knows. I can now publish any old thing I want, and if I manage to get on a blog that's attention-getting, or I draw attention to myself, hundreds, even thousands of people can read a post. My colleague Paul Spears just did a post on college professors, things he's learned, like 20 things he's learned as a college professor, that's been read at least by 20,000 people on our site in the last 2 weeks. Now, most academic books are read by 10,000 people. That's really ego-stroking. Now, what Paul has to realize is, now, was this a great post? Yeah, it was a great post, but it's not a great work of art. I've done things, you know, that have hit that many hits, and you have to get some humility, but I'm not going to get it from the Internet. So we have to go looking for people who will give us some humility, who will help us improve, because the free market isn't necessarily going to do that. The free market produced Legally Blonde, too. It produced most of the movies that are in the multiplex. I just went to see, Journey to the Center of the Earth and The Mummy 3. These are not great films, and the free market produced them, and what you would want to do is get a little humility and learn to make great blog posts, but you're going to need a new mechanism. It was an accidental good feature, Matt, that you learned humility by getting slammed around by the stupid editor. But lots of people learn discouragement and giving up from that same process. So let's keep what's good, that is learning humility, and try to find a new way to do it. I can give you a suggestion about how to do that.
Go for it.
Yeah, I think that if people work on a group blog, but they work on a group blog where behind the scenes people can say, that wasn't the strongest thing you've ever written, or make sure that somebody proofreads this for this kind of mistake, or try to avoid this in the future, or that was only harsh, you're going to need to find people that can do that for you because you're no longer going to have an editor who will do it for you. And you can seek those people out in situations like group blogs, or if you don't want to start a group blog, at least informal friendships, and this is where Facebook can help, where you find two or three people who are committed to the fact that you're an excellent blogger and an excellent person. They like you, and they don't have to keep repeating that all the time. But they'll also send you positive news when you write a good post. However, their primary purpose is to say, you blew it there, at least in my opinion, and give you that kind of feedback. Because let's face it, the people who comment on blog posts are useless. I have yet to go to a blog where I thought the comments were by and large worth reading or written by people who are typical of that blog reader. They're usually written by people who are gaining whatever little about a fame that they have by always tagging on the end of a blog post and becoming legends in that little community. So I think you have to do it privately, though I do take the negative criticism I receive seriously in a sort of fuzzy way, even from comment boxes, and try to say, okay, my post must be too long, like this answer is too long, so let me stop. Do you have a follow-up on that, Matt, things you know that you disagree with or you want to punch back a little bit?
No, I think that's really sound advice. I am suspicious of the increasingly suspicious of medium for young people because I'm not sure that we can effectively create those sort of self-regulating institutions that were there previously.
Yeah, but I'm suspicious of young people being given cars as well, Matt, and that's just the way it is. New technology came on the scene. Young people suddenly had the ability to leave the small town and go to downtown Chicago where they got overwhelmed by the vice of the big city, and they got to meet people that they probably shouldn't marry and married them anyway. And we're going to have to set up structures just like we did with the – I actually think the invention of the automobile was probably just as big a cultural shift as the new media. It's not sexy to say that anymore because the church has gotten used to it, and we've integrated social structures and rules to help people deal with it. So, for example, the fact that you can drive doesn't mean you should. So the young adults in my household aren't given cars. We don't say, here are keys to the car, go out and do whatever you want. Because there's an understanding that that technology, the automobile, has to be used intelligently. But I think right now a lot of parents, except for porn and other things that are obviously harmful, pretty much throw the keys to the internet to their kids and say, well, at least she's just on Facebook 24 hours a day, and she's not looking at bad sites or chatting with evil people. But, of course, she's, you know, wasting her time, essentially, in the same way that somebody just driving around endlessly in their car on a summer day could equally be wasting their time when they could be doing better or other things.
So John Mark Reynolds of the Tory Honors Institute, it sounds like there really is a lot going on the web right now in terms of, I mean, you have porn, you have the filth that you mentioned in the comment boxes, and at the same time there's a broader question where people are looking at the web and they're saying, okay, it seems like a filthy place. Ought we to use this technology anyway?
Yeah,
there are several companies like the High Calling or Salem Web Network and these people who are out there doing the good work. John Mark, what do you think Christians uniquely bring to the table to help redeem this technology and especially the conversation aspect of it? What do you think they uniquely bring to the table to help just raise the level of the technology so that it is good to be used?
Well, first of all, there are people here that are expert on that and are doing wonderful work helping. But let me push back on the assumption. I once heard George Gilder, who is overly fond of technology, I'm not as optimistic as he is, make this point, and I think it's truthy, if it's not exactly true, which is there's so much information on the internet that as a percentage of bad stuff, one suspects that the old corner drugstore may have had as a higher percentage. I mean, the old corner drugstore may have carried, you know, 10, 15 magazines, and two or three of them were in brown paper behind the counter. Now, of course, immediately, the technology enabled a notch generation of kids and young adults and people my age to access stuff we didn't want to access, presented us with huge temptations we weren't ready to handle, but you can see that Christian people are catching up with this, and they're beginning to build social structures where if you don't want to look at bad things, you don't have to. In fact, we might get to the point where we become too much gated. There are too many gated communities on the internet. Someone asked me a political question earlier, and I've noted with some dismay that most people only go to political sites that agree with their general worldview. You know, I read the Daily Kos every day. I also read, you know, Town Hall every day, but I think I'm unusual that way from what I can see from the data. So I think technology is catching up with our ability to filter and make sure that we're not just inundated by temptation, yet simultaneously you don't want to build the gated community so high that you literally could just set your bookmarks and your filter so that I only go to young earth creationists, Orthodox and evangelical websites that are Republican, and just cycle around what have to be thousands of interesting sites that would fit those general profiles. And that's too narrow. And so there's this equal concern on the other side. And it's just going to come down to our being discipled and being good people inside our churches.
Catherine, Marcus, or Matt, would you like to follow up with any questions for John Mark Reynolds of the Tory Honors Institute?
John Mark, this is Catherine Britton with Crosswalk.com again.
Yes.
I have a follow-up to Wade's question. One thing that Crosswalk recently ran across was a study by the Barna Institute.
Right.
The Barna Group, excuse me. And they were talking about how more and more Christians and churches even are jumping on social networking sites such as Facebook, and more of them than ever have websites now. Do you think that the future of the church is changing somewhat because of this technology, or is that a good thing that Christians are jumping on this?
Well, I think it's a good thing in the sense that it's good that even churches as retro as mine, and my church is still struggling with the 12th century, like was the 12th century a good idea or not, yet we have a website and we have a telephone. And so I think some of this is just we need to be there because we're people and we're there ourselves. We're there as people. But I think the second thing is you can't do church on new media. You can't do church on TV. Anybody who thinks that they've watched a church service on TV and that they've gone to church is fooling themselves. I mean, you have forsaken the fellowship of the brothers and sisters if you've done that. So the same way, you know, joining a Facebook group to stop slavery in the Sudan, or joining a Facebook group for my local church, and I am in a Facebook group for my local church, is not a substitute for actually going, because I'm still a soul in a body, not just a disembodied mind, you know, surfing the net. So can the church do this? Yes, but only if we realize that talking to the pastor on the phone isn't a substitute for going in. I go to a sacramental church, so obviously it's no substitute for the sacraments. But even if you aren't sacramental, you have a low view of communion, for example, a typical low view of the sacraments, you still need to go and fellowship with incarnate souls created in the image of God who are there embodied. Knowing some old people and getting to know them as old people, knowing some young people and getting to know them as young people, boy, that's still important because we're still human beings. That's all very obvious, right? And I assume that no church is actually making this mistake. But if any church is making this mistake, then shame on them and Ichabod to them.
Do you think overall churches are going to learn how to handle this in a good way?
Yeah, after they make, you know, 59 dumb mistakes, and what you'll notice is there'll be some really goofy group who will start the, I'm making this up and probably this exists, the first church of Facebook. And they'll try to substitute everything that the church does on Facebook, and they'll get a lot of media attention because that's a clownish thing to do, right? And people will bemoan the fall of Western civilization. People who are like I am, I like to bemoan the fall of Western civilization. It's kind of therapeutic every once in a while. I just put on my curmudgeon hat and play Chesterton for fun and profit. And people will do that, but by and large, people aren't goofballs, and I've met very few regular folk, the kind of folk I'm talking to right now on the phone, who don't think that you have to actually be with people to get to know them in the end. So something like God Blog Convention, I get asked all the time, why would we go to a convention and sit in rooms and talk to each other when we're talking about new media? And the answer is, I want to get to know you guys face-to-face. It matters that I'm 45. You know, I'm not handsome like Mel Gibson. I'm not young. I'm not particularly fit. And that's all part of who I am. And it's too easy to hide on new media. And so it's good to get together. I mean, I'm just kind of giving the negative side. But the positive side is we are who we are. And we want to be our whole package when we talk to people.
Well, thank you.
This is Marcus Goodyear with the HighCalling.org.
Hi, Marcus.
You've danced around this issue a little bit, but I just wanted to ask head on.
Dancing is fun. Don't make me deal with an issue head
well,
on.
Well, you know, I don't know. I go to a Baptist church.
So, yeah.
I'm kidding. Do you have a theology of blogging? Or to ask it kind of in layman's terms, what can people learn about God from blogging or from reading blogs? Or is that just a faulty question?
Well, I think fundamentally we learn about God from God and through the incarnation of his son, Jesus Christ, as best revealed to us in his inerrant word. And that's not going to change. Now, we can read the Bible on my iPhone. I have the ability to sit and read the Bible, and that's great. But in the end, it's reading the Bible. I'm not sure, other than being able to keep my notes and do better searches on the Greek text, which sadly the iPhone hasn't added yet, that there's really that much difference or advantage. So I don't think that we're going to end up with a uniquely special theology of blogging, or that the new media themselves are going to teach us anything about God any more than automobiles or cars did. I think that's giving too much credit to the new media. But maybe I've missed the import of your question. Would you like to follow up? I don't want to dance around anything.
Yeah, well, I was just kind of surprised by your answer. What I would rephrase it then is to say, what do we learn about our relationship to God? What do we learn about being Christians through new media? I mean, what does it look like essentially to be a Christian online? What is a God blog?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that the answer is, the first thing we learn is that an important part of who of what it is to be a person is your mental life and your mental activity, and that being expressed through language and being able to connect to many people online is just a delightful preview of paradise, of one aspect of paradise. And so we can begin to experience that. And it's like 800 Facebook friends, and you can kind of follow what they do and keep up with people that you couldn't otherwise dialogue with or see very often. Right, that's just a delightful foretaste of heaven. Technology is giving us an ability to do something that time will allow us to do in paradise, where we can know what everybody is doing because we have an infinite amount of time to get to know people and to get to know the people, the finite number of people that are there to know. So that's the good side of it. I think the thing that the new media also teaches us is that we are incarnate beings, that we do have bodies, and so there are limits to how much verbal or even video interaction can replace just face-to-face conversation. So I think the necessity of the incarnation and the centrality of the incarnation to the Christian message is brought home by new media. God so loved the world that he couldn't have just come and related to us on Facebook, set up a Facebook site. You know, he came and didn't just send us words, 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 or video, video, video. He came and had sweat and ate and dwelt among us, and we beheld, not indirectly, but we beheld, if you're the witness in John, his glory, glory as of the only begotten Son of the Father. And so there's both this great gift on the net, this ability for many different minds to interact, almost like angels. We live almost like angels or devils on the net, but we're not angels or devils. We're incarnate men and women. And so that's the way I would describe it. And in some ways, we get to experience what it's like to be Gabriel, I think, on the internet a little bit.
Can what you explain what like you mean by that?
Yeah, what it would be like to be disembodied and be able to embody yourself to appear as you want to be. Gabriel doesn't come, or Michael, the archangel, they don't come with bodies. And so they can appear, the medievals would have said, with airy bodies. They can appear in avatar form to enforce their message, to reinforce what they have to say. And, of course, we can all do that on the Internet. We're not, if you're handicapped, if you're legally blind, like some members of my family are, you don't have to be that when you're online. That doesn't have to be part of your presentation of self. And so in some ways, we can live a little bit like the angels without the limitation of physicality or geography. But not in the end, right? We are still men and women, and we are still sitting in chairs in our basements, even while we're blogging at 2 in the morning. So there's my crazy thought for today. So that's so crazy that you have read me out of the kingdom. The silence fills me with foreboding.
Oh, no, I was just waiting for Matt. I actually really liked that answer.
All right. Go ahead, Matt.
Well, I actually have to take off, so I don't know if that I'm going to be able to stay for this answer.
Okay.
But don't dance around.
And I probably have to take off, too, huh?
Yeah, don't dance around it, because we just don't want you dancing, period.
The view of me dancing is an ugly view that,
thank God you're not video casting yet.
Yeah, so true.
One of the things that Andrew Jones talked about a lot was when we talked to him, was the new direction online being more around life casting. Things like Twitter have really become important ways that people are communicating with each other. They're a lot more instant, a lot more pithy. What do you make of that? What does it bode ill or good for the future of Christian blogging? And I'm afraid I am going to have to go, so I'll catch your answer on the podcast.
Okay. Can you repeat the question? I want to make sure I have it exactly right, since you are not going to be here for the follow-up.
Yeah. Andrew Jones talked about life casting, things like Twitter, things as kind of the new direction in which the web is heading. Our thoughts being expressed contextually in the context of our whole lives, and more and more of our lives being expressed online, not just our heads.
Yeah.
What do you make of that, and what do you think it holds for the future of Christian blogging?
Well, I think it's by and large a good thing. When I talk about political blogging, you know, I try to put my whole self that it's appropriate to put online, online. However, the follow-up to that is that there are some parts of myself that it's not appropriate to put online. So, for example, my daughter had a 16th birthday this year, and I had some thoughts about that, and I intentionally didn't blog them. Now, I did blog some thoughts on my son leaving for college after I talked to him about it. And I said, well, I've shared some things with you. I'm thinking about putting some of what I feel online to help other people. Is that okay? Is that appropriate to you? Do you feel good about that? And he did feel good about it, so it was good. But I don't put every aspect of my life. Some things have to be kept sacred and private between my wife and myself, between my children and me. And I think that it can go too far where we cheapen sacred things by exploiting them every time for an ooh-ah blog post. And so I would want people to pick some part of their lives, some parts of their life, and keep those separate from what they're Twittering, what they're showing to other people, in the same way we do in real life. Look, Matt, there are some things about me that are none of your business, and we're actually really good friends. I'm saying friends at this point and colleagues. But there's some things that I'm not going to answer, some questions you're going to ask that I'm not going to answer. And if people don't keep that part of their lives private, I think that they'll regret it later.
Well, John Mark Reynolds, thank you for your time today. And if you want to come out and visit John Mark Reynolds out at GodBlogCon and as well with Marcus Goodyear and Matthew Anderson, engage in this conversation for yourself and ask him some questions. You know, we covered a lot of ground today talking about just what's out there on the web and how people ought to use the technology. This idea of the public and the private space is certainly intriguing in the world of Twitters and Facebook updates, etc. If you want to come out and be a part of the conference, visit www.godblogcon.com. That's www.godblogcon.com. Be sure to register today. We're filling up on all of our meals. In fact, I think we are now on the wait list for the opening night dinner. So that's very good news. I'm happy. Yay. John Mark, thank you very much. And Catherine Britton of Crosswalk.com, news and culture editor, thank you for your time today. Marcus Goodyear, thehighcalling.org, and Matthew Anderson of MereOrthodoxy.com have been your interviewees. My name is Dustin Stevie, and I'm the senior director of GodBlogCon. Thanks for listening.